In praise of the witty put-down. Discourse in America plumbed the depths in Brooklyn last year when a gathering of self-proclaimed witches solemnly cursed, I kid you not, a newly installed Supreme Court justice. No eyes of newt and horns of toad for these sorcerers. Rather, they expressed the ugliest sentiments in language that managed to encompass both the vile and the banal. This isn't a complaint about the fact that these folks think less than highly about a justice of the highest court in the land. They have a First Amendment right to air their views. My complaint concerns solely the sheer ugliness and dreariness of the language in which they did so. It calls to mind a wry comment about Rome's gladiatorial games and circuses in the 1st century AD by the poet Martial, Marcus Valerius Martialis, to give him his proper name. I could forgive the circuses all their cruelty, blood and vulgarity, he wrote, if it wasn't that they're so interminably boring. And that's the problem with the manner in which today's social critics on both sides of the aisle express themselves. Their comments are usually depressingly boring and almost always downright ugly. Whatever happened to bon mots, the swift, elegant and often hugely funny put-downs that were a regular feature of conversation and debate when I was young? I confess that, try as I might, I was never much good at that sort of thing. A witty riposte always seemed to spring to mind 10 minutes or so after the appropriate moment had passed. But I would have given my eye teeth of the timing and aplomb with which to deliver them. Sad to relate, it seems that today the art of the verbal riposte has gone the way of the dodo. All that's left is the churlish reply and the rude and oafish insult, and our language is much the poorer because of it. When it comes to bon mots, few could equal the mastery of Oscar Wilde. Never the sporting type, he summed up fox hunting as the unspeakable, engaged in the pursuit of the uneatable. America, he declared, is the only nation to have gone from barbarism to decadence without a period of civilization in between. He was particularly known for the tart rejoinder. Asked at a pretentious literary party if he was enjoying himself, he replied, "Well, there's nothing else to enjoy here, is there?" Even on his deathbed in a dreary boarding house in Dunkirk, France, Wilde was unable to resist a quip. "Either that wallpaper goes or I do," he declared. Wilde was one of the few people to get the better of playwright George Bernard Shaw, himself no mean exponent of the bon mot. Shaw once fulsomely praised a particularly witty quip by Wilde. "I wish I'd said that," he remarked. "Don't worry, Bernard," Wilde replied. "One day you will." Shaw was no less a master of the cutting riposte. One day, the noted Victorian actress and beauty, Mrs. Patrick Campbell, sought to compliment Shaw by lightheartedly suggesting they have a child together. "Imagine how wonderful it would be to combine my beauty with your brain," she exclaimed. Shaw dismissed the idea out of hand. "No, madam," he replied. "Think of what a catastrophe it would be if it were to have my beauty and your brains." Sir Winston Churchill was similarly fast on his feet. Lady Astor, the British parliamentarian and socialite, was once outraged by some statement by Churchill, and she blurted out, "Sir, if you were my husband, I would put poison in your tea." "Madam," replied Churchill suavely, "if I were your husband, I should drink it." Returned to the opposition benches in the Commons after the Second World War, Churchill complimented the man who unseated him, the socialist Prime Minister Clement Attlee. "Mr. Attlee is a very modest man," he began. After pausing, he added, "but then he has much to be modest about." On Attlee's side of the House, the Labour Party spokesman and journalist Michael Foote was noted for his acerbic wit. He was frequently at odds with Brendan Bracken, the fiery red-headed Irishman who served as Churchill's parliamentary secretary. "The honourable member is a complete phony," Foot once fumed exasperatedly. Even his hair, which looks like a wig, is real. Alice Roosevelt, the contrarian daughter of President Theodore Roosevelt, remarked with impeccable sense of timing, "If you've got nothing good to say about anybody, come and sit by me." A quick wit can also have practical uses. It saved Robert Clive, the former governor of Bengal for the British East India Company, from impeachment. Clive returned to England from India in the latter part of the 18th century, having amassed a fabulous fortune worth millions upon millions of dollars in today's money. His political enemies soon accused him of using his governorship and abusing it by ruthlessly plundering the people he ruled. Standing before the bar of the House, Clive heard the prosecution detail the bribes he'd received. Vast piles of gems, including rubies, diamonds, emeralds, sapphires and pearls, and thousands of lakhs of golden coins. A lakh is an Indian unit representing 100,000. "What do you have to say to that?" he was asked. "When I think of what I might have had," he replied, "I'm astonished at my moderation." He was exonerated completely. The 18th century was rich with men as witty as Clive, not all of them admirable. One such was John Wilkes, a rake-hell womaniser and Member of Parliament. On one occasion he was hauled before the bar of the House of Commons, accused of libelling the Bishop of London. The Earl of Sandwich, assigned as prosecutor for the impeachment hearing, delivered an eloquent and devastating indictment of Wilkes' character, concluding contemptuously, "This man is doomed to die either on the gallows or of an unspeakable disease." At this, Wilkes leapt to his feet. "That, sir," he declared, "depends upon whether I embrace your morals or your mistress." He was acquitted amid howls of laughter. Among the sharpest wits of my youth was John Grosser, a colleague at the Times of London, and one of the paper's parliamentary correspondents. Towering well over 6 foot, Grosser was an accomplished sportsman, a rugby, football and field hockey international. Incongruously, perhaps, he was also a noted bon viveur and dandy. One day, in pouring rain, Grosser's Savile Row tailor delivered a new, superbly cut Irish tweed suit to his fashionable apartment, a stone's throw from the Houses of Parliament. Grosser was quite unable to resist the urge to show it off. "Put one drop of rain on it and all the creases will come out," he wailed to the apartment block's doorman. He was escorted to his waiting taxi under the shelter of a vast umbrella. Ensconced in the cab, Grosser instructed the driver not to stop at the Parliament's main gate, but rather to take him directly to the more convenient St. Stephen's entrance. "This suit is simply a glorious example of the tailor's art," he infused, preening himself. "The softest Irish tweed, very hard to cut. Only a master can handle it. The trouble is a drop of rain on it, dearie, and all the creases will come out. But I simply couldn't resist wearing it. It's absolutely gorgeous." The driver dropped him off as he was bidden, and having been paid off with a handsome tip, he could no longer restrain himself. "Here, mate," he shouted, "all you bleeding need is earrings." "Earrings, dearie," replied Grosser, quick as a flash. "Never with tweed." Ends.